Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, another member of the 2011 November 9, Matt Gianetti, one of the guys trying to win the World Series of Poker main event. They still have two more months before they'll actually play out that final table. He will be our guest at this final table on today's show. In our poker coach segment, we'll have John Hemmer from StackemCoaching.com talking about raising out of the blinds and playing out of position. All that ahead in the course of the next hour. Hello, I am Paul Harrah's, sitting at the feature table in the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is just about $54,000, and the cash games and tournaments are going on, and our PLO game will start as soon as this show is over today. My partner, Dennis Phillips, is once again in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing great. In Vegas and enjoying the weather.
Now, I'm guessing that you're having a little bit of withdrawal because I know that this weekend, PokerStars started their World Championship of Online Poker. And since you live in Las Vegas and are an American who still is in America, you can't play. Are you feeling a little withdrawal from that?
I guess that's one way to put it. It's just wrong. It's just not right. We're working hard to try and get this situation rectified and actually making some progress. I can't really talk a whole lot about it, but I guess I can say that it appears that the DOJ is looking favorable upon PokerStars now. They have a number of small actions, a number of reviews, and the indications are that they like what they see. The fact that PokerStars operates in another 100 countries around the world, the fact that everybody else seems to have absolutely no problem with PokerStars other than the U.S., the fact that they've opened up their books, the fact that they paid back their players, it goes on and on. So maybe sometime in the near future we'll be able to get back and play online like we should have been able to the whole time.
I'm glad we're talking about this at the top of the show because there was a story that broke over the weekend that I don't understand, and since you know some of the people in PokerStars, maybe you can explain it to me. I know you're limited in what you're allowed to say about these sort of things. Even if you know a lot about it, there are certain things you can't say on the air that's still kind of private PokerStars stuff. But there was a story over the weekend that the Department of Justice, through the Southern District of New York, which is where the indictments were brought against 11 people back on April 15th, which effectively shut down online poker by the big sites in America, that the DOJ has agreed to release some of PokerStars' money, something like whatever money was in this account in, I think it was in Luxembourg or somewhere, except for like $5.5 million. That's what I got out of the story, but I don't understand what this was because I didn't know why they were releasing it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I do know what you're talking about. And again, a lot of the information, the amount of the money that was released, everything like that, has not been made public knowledge yet. I guess in general, what I can say is that this is just another plus and another thing that the DOJ is sort of saying, well, Starr seems to be doing everything right. The original indictment was for $3 billion against these people. And they froze, I believe it was, three PokerStars accounts outside of the country.
And let me just interrupt and say the $3 billion was not against PokerStars. It was against PokerStars and Full Tilt Poker and Absolute Poker.
And Ultimate Bet, correct.
Right.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. You know, no designation to who was paying what or how they were going to collect it or any of this stuff.
Yep.
But of the three accounts, this is the first one now that has been released. They did require Starrs to leave a certain amount of money in there, which they did with no problem. Everything above and beyond that was released back to Starrs with the DOJ's blessing. To me, that's huge. It says that they're basically trusting Starrs now, and you know they're working with them, and hopefully something is going to move forward on this. Unfortunately, this can't be said for anybody else that's involved in this indictment, but
yeah.
as far as STARS goes, it seems to be moving forward and moving forward in a favorable way.
Now, that money that was released, that was not player money, right? Because STARS has given people back their money.
Correct. Nobody knows the exact amount. They almost immediately send back $100 million, and since then they send back a ton more. So any and everyone in the U.S. who has not gone online and collected the money from STARS is able to do that with no problems whatsoever. They did it with their FTT points. They did it with everything right there. So
yep.
STARS has done everything right. They've opened their books. They've proved everything. The DOJ seems to be giving them a blessing, and I think that's just awesome.
Okay. Now, while we're talking about online poker, and every day I play in a live game, I don't play poker every day, but each time I go out and play in a live game, usually playing PLO here at Harris, somebody comes up to me and says, what's the story with getting my money back from Full Tilt? What's the story with getting it back from Ultimate Bet? What's the story with getting it back from Absolute Poker? And I tell them, right now, there is no story. Your money is not coming back anytime soon. And last Tuesday on the show, we talked about how one of Full Tilt's attorneys, Jeff Ifrah, had taken to the 2+2 forums online and tried to give some information, but it was in an unofficial capacity. After we got off the air last week, Full Tilt did issue an official statement, which was, as far as I know, the first communication from the company to its players in a long time. And here's what they said. Full Tilt Poker was not prepared for the far-reaching U.S. government enforcement effort of Black Friday. Over the 2 years preceding Black Friday, the government seized approximately $115 million of player funds located in U.S. banks. In addition, a key payment processor stole approximately $42 million from Full Tilt Poker. Full Tilt never anticipated that the DOJ would proceed as it did by seizing our global domain name and shutting down the site worldwide. Over the last 4 months, Full Tilt has been actively exploring opportunities with outside investors in order to stabilize the company and pay back our players. At least six of these groups have visited Dublin to inspect the operation. We've got an additional financial advisor who we've engaged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea is to get new management in here, restore the site, and repay the players. Now, I want to parse this just a little bit, Dennis, because there are a couple of things in here that don't make sense to me. And one is, as you and I have talked about, while PokerStars did a good job of keeping player funds separated from company funds, it's apparent from what we've heard in the last 5 months that Full Tilt did not do that. And proof of that would be the fact that a key payment processor stole approximately $42 million from Full Tilt Poker. That's not players' fault. That's not a reason that the company wouldn't have the money that was supposedly put aside for the players. And if the government seized company funds and locked everything up, then how are they paying their lawyers? How are they paying whoever it is to pay the travel expenses for people to get to Dublin? Where do they have any kind of money? And I would ask, have any of their pros gotten any of the money in the course of the last 5 months? Because if all of that came before the players, which the company says is its first priority, then we have a really big problem here, bigger than we may have thought.
Well, I don't know, Paul. The $42 million is an alleged was stolen from them. Again, that's not been proven. There's been no indictments or anything like that. We don't know for sure. Was there mismanagement in there? Yes. Now then, I want to be a little careful on this. Under the Isle of Man, where PokerStars is at, they are required with fairly stringent rules for like separation of the money, corporate from players' deposits, everything like that. STARS followed that to the T, absolutely no problem. Other jurisdictions, such as where Full Tilt was at, do not require that. Therefore, Full Tilt was not doing anything under their licensing that was illegal. Now, was it good management? Was it smart? Was it a whole lot of other things? Not going to comment on that. Was it the proper or the ethical thing to even do? I'm not even going to comment on that. But they weren't doing anything technically or illegally wrong underneath their jurisdiction. What that does to me is says that the jurisdiction was probably wrong. That's why we have been supporting, including STARS, regulation of this industry in the U.S. so so that situations like this don't develop.
Yep.
I turn around and put a lot of the blame right back on the people that stick their head in the sand and totally ignored this for five freaking years, instead of coming out and making a clear cut and no gray area so that we know exactly what to do so the players can feel safe and comfortable and know that their money is not being spent anywhere else. And I fully believe that had something happened in 06, 07, or 08, we would not be having this discussion now, and we would be playing online, and we would not have any of these problems.
I think those are great points, and you're absolutely right. There was a lack of responsibility by the people who should have been doing it in this country, but I also think there was some, I don't know if it was incompetence or malevolence or what it was, something that was not being done at Full Tilt Poker that should have been done in that ethical and moral way that you were discussing there. And I should point out that the Alderney Gambling Control Commission, the AGCC, in Dublin, Ireland, they're the ones who do license Full Tilt Poker. They have withdrawn their license from them. They have another hearing that's now been scheduled for Tuesday, September 19th. It will be in London. Hopefully it will be public, because the players want to know what's happening with their money. I'm not talking about just high-stakes guys who may have 5, 6, 7-figure amounts online. I'm talking about your average everyday player who may just have a few hundred or a few thousand dollars online, and they want to get that money back. You know, money's tight for a lot of people now, and to have it locked up month after month after month without knowing when you might be able to get it back is completely unfair to all of them. So when we hear more about that, we'll let you know. And by the way, that lawyer I mentioned who went on 2 plus 2 a week and a half ago and talked a little bit about this, Jeff Ifra is his name. He and his company have filed a motion to step down as the attorneys of record for Howard Lederer, Andy Block, Chris Ferguson, Mike Mattisau, Jennifer Harmon, Alan Cunningham, Eric Lindgren, and Eric Seidel, who were the players who were the top pros who all had a part of the company. We don't know how that was structured at all, but they've asked to step away from it, saying that continued representation of them would create unreasonable difficulty for us to carry out our employment effectively and result in an unreasonable financial burden to our law firm. I don't know what any of that means. I just know it means that things are not going the way the people at Full Tilt would like them to go. And unfortunately, not going well for the players. Now, let's move on to something else here. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. Today, Dennis, is the first day of the second main event for the Epic Poker League. We've been talking about this quite a bit over the last few months. And, in fact, Annie Duke, the commissioner of the league, was on the Late Show with Craig Ferguson on CBS last night. And I thought she did a fine job, and we can talk about that in a moment. But I've been looking online for the last couple of hours since this thing has started. They're about an hour and 12 minutes into play today. I haven't seen anybody reporting any numbers on who is showing up or how many are showing up, but we do know that the Pro-Am this weekend, which last month had 190 people buy into it for $1,500, this week had only 97 players entering into it. And considering that the league guaranteed 9 seats into today's $20,000 main event, that means they guaranteed 180K, and they probably came up about 35K short with the buy-ins from the players. So we're probably going to see lower numbers today for the 20K, particularly with the WPT and the EPT and other things going on around the world. What does all of this mean for Epic?
Again, nobody knows for sure. The verdict's not in on it. The fact that they only got 97, they were disappointed in the 190. Now we only get 97. Now, I mean, I've heard people say that because the W Coupe starting with Stars, and such a major online tournament that you're going to have people there. There are other tournaments going on. There's a lot of things going on in Europe, and a number of people are overseas for that. All sorts of excuses. But the thing of it is, if you had 97 people there, I don't know what percentage of those were actually the card-carrying people, but a pretty good chunk of them were, because I recognized a whole lot of names. Everybody from Phil Hellmuth to Huckseed to Nomly to whatever down there that played over there. So, say a third of them are card-carrying people. That means you're only able to attract 60 non-card-carrying people to play in your pro-am for a chance to qualify for this? Yeah, it does not speak well. Not for sure what changes, what needs to be done, but they were even offering some incentives, backpacks, rebates, something or other to get people to play down there, and it just wasn't working. I think they even had a couple of the pros go down there and play in their satellites. And if you knock the pro out, you got a seat in another satellite.
Yep.
So they're trying to do it other ways. Jeffrey Pollack is very innovative, a very good businessman. He, whoever down there is trying to come up with some ways. But 97 people to not even meet the minimum requirement to have to put an overlay on it is not good. This does not speak well at all.
Yeah. By the way, in one of those bounty tournaments, Andy Block was the player with a bounty on his head.
Yep.
Nobody won it because Andy won.
Why does that not surprise me?
so he won his way into the $1,500 Pro-Am, and when you talk about players who already have cards, when they got to the final nine, three of them already had cards. Greg Mueller, who won the thing, Nam Lee, who came in second, Phil Hellmuth was at the final table. The other six were Andreas Hoivold, Sean Getzwiller, Brandon Myers, Russell Rosenblum, Jeffrey Osmus, and Michael DeVita. Two of those people won seats via the Pro-Am for the first main event, and Getzwiller actually made the final table in that and won about $71,000. Now, I have a couple of other stories about this that we have to get to, but I want to ask you a question here, which is essentially when there's no cash beyond the seats that they're giving away, which is what they had here because they didn't make the guarantee, does that dissuade other players from getting involved here? Because $1,500, remember, that's a lot of money for your average poker player. You may want to go and try to beat the best in the world in their 20K buy-in event, but to spend $1,500 with the chance of only getting that seat but no cash in return, effectively you've turned this into a mega satellite.
Correct.
Is that going to attract enough non-card pros?
Well, the problem you have is you have such a tough field. Is that going to discourage some of the people from going there? You don't turn out enough people, so there isn't any extra money or anything like that, and you're only playing for the seats. Is that going to distract some people? I mean, you just keep coming up with these things that take maybe a few more people and a few more people and a few more people that aren't playing in it, and you end up with 97 people in your program. And then it turns the final table into a farce. Did you hear about the final table?
I'm getting
a little off subject here.
Oh, go ahead.
The final table, they played for a day and a half.
Oh, and let me just interrupt you before you do that, because I just saw this. As of right now, they're an hour and 15 minutes into the main event, and people can buy in for the first 8 hours, so there will be a lot more people showing up. There are 68 people.
Oh, my God.
68 people who have either qualified through that Pro-Am or bought in for the full 20K.
Wow. Well, there's only six of them that qualified. So the others are card-carrying people. But, wow. Okay. Let's hope that a whole lot of people flock down to the Palms and play down there.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead with what you were saying about the final table.
They get to the final table. There's nine seats available. The cameras are ready. They're going to film this final table with Hellmuth and Mueller and Nam Lee and Sean, who's had a heck of a summer there. They get down and sit, and everybody looks and goes, oh, what the heck. 45 minutes, it's over. They eliminate eight people in like 10 or 12 hands. They had a three-way shove with the third guy calling with a 10-deuce offsuit.
Because they're not playing for anything. I mean, everybody who's at that final table, the final nine, they've already won a seat into the main event. And essentially, the pros are really just playing for points on Epic's Global Poker Index.
Correct.
That's all there is. So they turned it into a five-minute turbo.
Yeah, absolutely. It just it wasn't poker all of a sudden. It was, let's see how soon we can get done so we can go have a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was nothing but a satellite. That's exactly what it was.
Now, there is controversy again about one of the players. We talked last month about Chino Ream and the disciplinary action they took against him after he won the first main event. Well, I mentioned that one of the guys at this final table of the Pro-Am this weekend was a guy named Michael DeVita. He officially finished in eighth place, even though they all tie technically. He officially finished in ninth place. Yesterday, he goes down to the Palms to register because he's won a seat into today's main event. He shows up, and they won't let them register, and eventually they escort them off the property and tell them, you're not welcome in the main event. You're not welcome back here at the Palms. Here's the $1,500 you paid to buy into the Pro-Am. You can't play in the main event. It turns out that Michael DeVita is a convicted sex offender.
Yeah.
And according to Epic's player code of conduct, while criminal conduct is clearly outside the scope of permissible professional conduct, and persons who engage in serious criminal conduct are subject to league discipline, our standard of conduct as professional poker players is considerably higher. It is not simply enough to avoid being convicted of a serious criminal offense. So they're trying to turn things up and make everything a little bit more professional, and having a convicted sex offender make your final table and then make your main event does not help the image of either the Epic Poker League or, frankly, poker in general, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's just, you would hope, and I don't know how for sure you'd do it, that this would have been caught before he qualified for it, before he went back down there to grab his seat.
Well, I don't know how you do that, though. How are you going to do that?
That's why I was saying it. I said you would hope it would catch. You would hope, you know, I'm not for sure how. I think that their code of ethics, my thoughts, was the code of ethics was in there so that if somebody is caught cheating in Europe, you know, it becomes a part of his record, and therefore they don't want him in here. That if, you know, anything that way would definitely generate a ban. But instead of that, they're getting into Chino Reams and whether he pays his bills or not, and now they're getting into a conviction on a guy that we know nothing about. Again, I don't know. Was this when he was 18 with a 15-year-old, or was this something that happened much? I don't want to say anything about it because I don't know anything about it. But I think they've opened a can of worms here that's going to be awfully, awfully hard to follow.
There's no way. There's no way you can run a background check on everybody.
Right.
This guy walks up to the cashier. Hi, here's my $1,500. Here's my $20,000. Here's my $180, whatever the buy-in is. You expect the casino to run a background check on them and decide whether they're allowed to play? Now, I understand what Jeffrey and Annie are trying to do in elevating the image of the professional poker player and, frankly, all poker players. In fact, last night on Craig Ferguson, Craig asked her, you know, can these guys wear sunglasses and hats and all that sort of stuff? And she said, well, in the Epic Poker League, we don't let you wear a hoodie with the hood pulled up. You have to show your face. You can wear sunglasses, but we want you to present a professional appearance. And frankly, you and I have talked about this, Dennis, about how many poker players, when they get caught on TV on ESPN during the World Series of Poker or at the Heartland Poker Tour or whatever it is, they show the rest of the world that there are some poker players who are just absolute slobs. And it does not bode well for the image that we're trying to get out there. If you want to get big corporate sponsors, you know, Apple and Nike and Pepsi and all of these, they want to be able to know that the people who are going to be wearing or near the people who are wearing their logos are going to give off a positive image. And too many of them do not. So I applaud Jeffrey and Annie for trying to raise the bar for the image of poker players. But I don't know how you can do something like this unless you're going to run background checks on everybody who ever enters every event, which is unmanageable.
Yeah, there's no way you can do it. Again, as I said, they've opened a can of worms, and I'm not for sure that they're going to do it. I totally agree with you. I think the idea of trying to raise the standards, of making everybody, you know, aware of everything, I like a lot of what their ideas are. I'm just not for sure how the heck they're going to implement them. And I agree, Jeffrey Pollack, Annie, that's something that I love for them, the ideas behind it. They've had two events, and both of them have been marred. And what are you going to remember about the start of the Epic Poker League?
Yep.
That's
absolutely right. Now, one other Epic-related story. This didn't happen at the Epic Poker League, but it involved the guy who won the Pro-Am this weekend, Greg FTP Mueller. This didn't happen after he won it. This happened after day 1B when he was the chip leader. The tournament ends, and he and a couple of buddies go over to the Aria to shoot some craps. And, well, I'm going to just let Greg tell the story. This is audio that was on the Epic Poker League website this morning, an interview that Lizzie Harrison did with Greg. Just let him tell the story. Roll it, Jason.
Well, I was shooting dice with my buddy Sean Buchanan. Him and his girlfriend were standing across from me. And I was with my buddy Kyle. He was standing beside me. And I had some flags out, and it's almost good that it happened because I'm a little careless sometimes. Instead of keeping them, I wear basketball shorts, so I don't like to keep things in my pocket. So I had the flags on the side of my left side. And there was suspicious, there's...
Like on the rail of the craps table?
Yeah, like, you know how you keep them in the little slot
yes,
there,
yes,
right?
Okay.
Well, at the craps table, you know, you can't just judge people that maybe look like they're poor or look like they're rich. You see all kinds. I mean, you know, so you can't, especially in this gambling world, you can't judge people by what they're wearing or if they look shady or they don't look shady. So people always come around the dice table and they may shoot, surprise you and shoot really big. They may not shoot. They may watch. They may be friendly. They may be goofy. So you just don't really know. But there was this one dude lingering around, and he was even really close to Sean's girlfriend, where a couple times Sean told me after this all went down, he was like, God, I kept wanting to say, hey, watch your purse, Tina, to his girlfriend. And anyways, so long story short, he comes over to our side, and when I'm shooting dice, I'm having fun, I'm loud, I'm joking around, I'm not really staring at my chips.
Right.
So all of a sudden, my buddy sees my $5,000 chips just shake, and he goes, count your flags. So I counted them, and I had thrown Sean some money and back and forth, and so I was like, I think I'm missing one. He never saw anything happen. He just saw the move. And then he saw the guy, suspicious guy, just kind of walk the other way. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm missing a chip. I go, that guy grabbed a chip. And he walked away. And then as soon as he got around a slot machine, boom, he started sprinting. So I was like, that guy just robbed me. So I immediately started chasing him. And so did my buddy. And we both just, we took different directions kind of because there's a slot machine aisle. So he went this way, I went this way. We started chasing him through like by the Deuce Lounge. Like just, he was zigging and zagging. He turned to me, saw me, went the other way. My buddy went to grab him. He grabbed, and he got a hold of him, ripped the shirt right off him. The guy kept going. Then he went out by the poker entrance, by that valet. He went out there. And then my buddy grabbed him again because every time he would come to me, he would turn around. So it was like, it kind of froze him a bit. Like, you know that game Frogger, like you're zigging and zagging, right? So then my buddy grabbed him. He got away again. My buddy pushed him down. He got to the ground. Then he just cuffed him like this. And he came up, and I go, ship the flag right now. Nothing happens to you. I won't press charges. I won't knock you out. Just ship the flag. And it was like he looked at me. He knew that I knew that he had it, even though I really didn't. And he just pulled it out of his pocket and gave it to me. And at that time, there was like, as soon as it all happened, like when your adrenaline's going, you're not observant who's around. I mean, there could be naked girls standing beside you. It could be like 100 pit bulls. You don't know because your adrenaline's like, you know, that guy's robbed me. He's not going to get away with it. So anyways, then there was like 8 security guards standing there and they just took over from there, you know. So it was like, honestly, I wasn't really going to do anything about it after he gave me the flag. Once I got the flag, I was fine, you know. I mean, but security took over, and bad luck for him that they were there. Because I told them, give me the flag and nothing will happen to you. But, you know, they showed up and took care of business. So, I mean, you know, in the big scheme of things, 5,000 is not that much. But it is when you feel like you're violated or someone's trying to heist you. So if I have any chance of getting him, he's not going to get away.
Greg Mueller telling a story about his $5,000 flagship, so-called because of the red, white, and blue coloring around the outside. A little incident at the craps table at Aria. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in St. Louis. Time now for our poker coaching segment brought to you by StackemCoaching.com, where you can use the promo code FINALTABLE and get a free trial of Stack'em Coaching. Today's coach is John Hemmer. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What do you got for us today?
Today I just want to talk about raising out of the blinds or raising out of position in a normal 1-2 game.
Okay.
So in a 1-2 game, I just want to say it's okay to play ace-king, ace-queen, jack-jack type hands passively out of the blinds when it limps to you by just calling to see a flop or just calling a raise instead of 3-betting. You're going to keep the pot smaller, and you're going to find yourself in a lot less difficult situations out of position. And this will help reduce your variance in the long run. And then I just want to say, don't get caught up playing top pair, top kicker in a multi-way limp pot. You don't have to stack off on these flops. You know, it's okay to fold ace-king. So when you have aces, kings, and queens in the same situation, I usually advocate raising big pre-flop. you'll be surprised at how many callers you get. This makes your stack size shallower post-flop and allows you to either get your stack in on the flop or the turn by just bet the flop and the turn. With these hands, the only time you're really sure you're ahead is on the pre-flop and on the flop. So these hands play a lot easier if you get most of the money in pre and on the flop. And last, I just wanted to say, you know, don't worry about looking tight. Believe me, no one notices.
Quick question, John. What about three betting? You know, if you're out of position, obviously, and you do make a raise with, you know, a mediocre hand of some sort and you get three betted, I mean, what kind of hands can you actually stay in there with, or are you just donating to the pot?
You're referring to when you call in position?
Correct.
You're being three bet? I usually like to fold to a lot of these. You don't see a lot of three betting in a 1-2 game. Usually when someone does three bet, they have a pretty narrow range of aces, kings, queens, maybe ace-king some percent of the time. But then again, when you know that they have a narrow range like that, if they make it small enough and the stack sizes are deep enough, if you're over 100 big blinds deep, maybe you're 150 or 200, it's okay to play some speculative hands, you know, like 8-9 suited and pocket fives, that kind of thing, because you're pretty sure you're going to get paid when you hit your hand since they have such a narrow range.
Is part of the reason you're talking about when you three bet with aces, kings, or queens out of the blinds that you want to bet big is because if you're going to get called, you want to be called in just one place. You don't want three, four, five. You don't want the train to start rolling all the way around to the caboose on the button.
Right, right. It just makes the hand easier to play. You know, if it limps to you and you make it big and you get one or two callers heads, or you know, you get a heads up or three way. The stack sizes are just going to be a lot shallower. So if you have $100 in the pot and you have $100 behind, you can just shove the flop. Whereas if you have like a $60 pot or something like that with a smaller three bet, it makes it difficult because you'd have $140 behind and then you'd have to bet like $40 and then hopefully get the money on the turn. So it just makes the hand easier to play, I think, when you raise bigger preflop.
Good stuff from John Hemmer, one of the coaches you'll find online right now at StackemCoaching.com, where you can rethink poker. Use the promo code FINALTABLE and get a free trial of StackemCoaching.com. We're happy to have them as our poker coach segment sponsor. Thank you, John.
Yep, thanks, guys.
We're back in a moment with Matt Gianetti, one of this year's November 9 for the World Series of Poker main event. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, available via iTunes or on thechipleader.com anytime on demand. And you can listen to us live every Tuesday at 3 in St. Louis on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live from Harrah's Poker Room in St. Louis, and from Las Vegas as well. Hello, I'm Paul Harrah with my partner Dennis Phillips. Matt Gianetti, one of this year's November 9, will join us in just a couple of minutes. Before he does, we do want to congratulate the three women who were on Friday night inducted into the Women in Poker Hall of Fame, one of whom will be our guest next week. That's Christy Gazes. Dennis, you know more about this than I do. Tell us about these women.
Well, Christy, for example, has been playing for over 20 years. She's ranked in the top 20 female earners ever. She's got over $1 million in tournament wins, and she's still doing quite well. This summer, she had a couple of impressive runs. She cashed in two events at this year's World Series of Poker. So she's been a huge supporter of the poker industry. Margie Hines was the second one. Now, she's been director of poker operations at the El Dorado Casino up there in Reno, Nevada. And she holds an interesting piece of history. She was the first woman ever to deal the World Series of Poker in 1977. And she went on to deal the first televised final table on CBS's Wide World of Sports that covered the event.
Wow.
So she's been there from the beginning. And then the third one was Phyllis Cairo. She's director of poker operations for the Hollywood Park Casino out in Los Angeles. And she has been involved in poker since 1979. She's held every position you can imagine in the poker operations. She's also been helping to write a number of books. Mike Cairo's Book of Tales, Poker for Women, Cairo on Gambling, the quiz book that he put out, a ton of different things that way. So she's been involved for 40 years in poker, the same as the other two people. Long time here, a long time supporter of it, and a couple of great people. So
yeah.
Welcome to the Hall of Fame. I'm sure that started in 08, the Hall of Fame did. I was there the first night when they introduced the original people to it. Mike Sexton helped to do it. They're supporting his organization, Poker Gives, the charity one there. And it's just nice to be able to recognize some of these women that have been for the last 20, 30, and 40 years working to make poker more available to everybody and doing the same things that, well, like Annie's trying to do there with the Epic Poker League, raise it to a higher higher standard and just, you know, let everybody play poker and have fun.
Yep. You know what's most impressive about these women who have been doing it for decades is we talk about these small percentages of women who play now. The main event has for years only gotten 3, 3.5, maybe 4% of the field is women. You sit down in any live poker room, and the percentage of women is small. There's one, maybe two women at a table full of men. That's today in 2011. You can imagine how much more difficult it was 20 or 30 years ago when the numbers were even smaller.
Oh, absolutely. There had to be times when they would walk into a poker room and they would be the only female there. So, you know, kudos to these gals for sticking it out and for doing as well as they did in a male-dominated sport. Christy has over $1 million in earnings in tournaments. And
yep.
She got those by grinding it out and fighting against fields that were 95 to 99% men. And she held
yep.
her own.
Yep, absolutely. And we're going to have her back on the show next week. She actually had a very deep run in the main event this year. And that's not her specialty. She's actually a limit poker player, so going out there and doing that well in a no-limit event like this, which she's done before, extraordinary. So we look forward to talking to her about that, and congratulations to Margie and Phyllis as well. Some sad news for the poker world this weekend. Twi Doan died. Now, you may not know Twi, and Dennis, I don't know if you ever met her personally, but this is a young woman who right out of college started playing poker professionally and very quickly became a major force at the cash games in Las Vegas. She worked her way up very quickly to the 10-20 games. She would take shots at 25-50. People who we respect, like Barry Greenstein, said that not only was she a really, really good cash game player, but also a heck of a nice person, which explains why in December 2009, when she found out that she had a cancerous tumor in her leg, she had to shave her leg because of the therapy, and a whole bunch of poker players, including Barry and Doyle Brunson and Phil Ivey and Tom Dwan and Elia Lesra and Elke, all showed their support for her by shaving their heads as well while she was undergoing the chemotherapy. So, you know, she had a lot of great and high-powered friends. Pretty good for a young lady who was only in her early 20s at the time. Unfortunately, the cancer finally finished her off this weekend. She succumbed to cancer a couple of days ago at the young age of 25, and losing anybody at that age is a sad thing. But someone that respected by the poker community is really a loss for the whole poker community.
I agree totally. I'm reading about it. I really didn't know her very well. But I know her reputation, and it speaks volumes for the quality of a person she was. And for anybody, 25 years old, it's just not right. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yep. While we're talking about cancer and that sort of thing, I do want to mention that Gary Wise, who writes for ESPN.com, has a very nice piece on the site right now about Chad Brown and his wife, Vanessa Russo. Chad, who we told you earlier this year, was fighting some cancer and horrible stuff in his gut. And Vanessa, who, you know, has had to go out and still play poker and deal with this disease that her husband was fighting. He seems to be doing much better after he got all the therapy that he needed. And it's months later, and you know, we keep our fingers crossed and hope that that will continue to turn good news. But if you want to read something very nice about it, I think one of poker's premier couples, Chad Brown and Vanessa Russo, go read Gary Wise on ESPN.com. While we have a moment here before Matt Gianetti joins us, let me get a plug in for this casino that I'm sitting in right now, which is Harrah's St. Louis. They've got another 10K double shootout scheduled for the last Saturday of this month. That's September 24th. $200 buy-in. You win the whole thing, and you could get $10,000 every day. Between now and then, of course, they've got other tournaments going on with buy-ins as low as $60. In fact, there are 10 of those tournaments every week, the $60 tournaments. You can find out the full schedule by going to harrahs.com/STL poker. And I'll also tell you that outside of the poker room, they have other things going on, including Monday through Thursday. You come in and play the slots or the table games and earn 10 base reward credits, and you get a dollar worth of Powerball coupons or lottery scratchers. The more credits you earn, the more coupons and scratchers you can get. And if you come in Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays in September, you can swipe your card for a chance to play the Hit It Big Machine, where you can win up to $500,000 every time you play. And should we tell them about the big game, Dennis?
Oh, we might as well mention it. What's going on, I believe, is a big game in St. Louis. It's going to be at the end of October. I'm going to have people coming in from all around. Probably be the biggest poker game ever in St. Louis. So you've been kind of spearheading this thing a little bit, Paul. Not for sure how many people are coming or who all is coming, but it sounds like it's going to be a heck of a good time.
Yeah, we're guaranteed one table and probably looking to get two tables of $25.50 no limit with a $10 ante. So we're talking about a really big game here. We've got some guys with very deep pockets who are coming in from all over the region who are going to play in this game. If you want to play in it, there is a $15,000 minimum buy-in. And yes, we have gotten quite a bit of interest from people here in town and from down in Tunica and up in Chicago and over at the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, where you and I were a couple of weeks ago, and from the people who play at Harrah's in Kansas City and from Tulsa and from various other places, people who want to come up. It's going to be a big deal. In addition to the $25.50 game with the $10 ante, we're also going to run a 10-20 game with a $5 ante that will kind of serve as a feeder game for that. It won't be a must move into the bigger game, but it will be a backup game in that the people who are on the list for the $25-50 game can sit in and play in that one, maybe hit a big hand, bankroll themselves up into the big game, and kind of free roll into that. So you're going to play in this, and I know you're talking to some people from where? Reno and other places who are interested?
Oh, yeah. There's always an interest for a good game, and so we're trying to promote it and see. There could be people from out on the East Coast, from California, from Texas. Who knows where all they're going to be coming in from. As you said, it looks like we've already got at least a table and a half reserved, and we're still a month away from there,
yeah.
Month and a half. So we'll see what happens, but I think we'll end up with three tables, to be quite honest.
Well, if we get two tables, I think we'll all be very, very happy about that. And if it goes successfully, you know, maybe we make it a regular quarterly thing here at Harrah's St. Louis. It is going to be the biggest game in a casino in Missouri history, not just St. Louis history. And we look forward to having it here. And by the way, if you do want to come, we are working, and you're out from out of town, we will work out hotel discounts for you here, and we'll give you directions on wiring your money to the cage and all the rest. Just get in touch with us. You can email DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. Dennis and I both check that email account. And I'll be happy to send you the details on the dates and everything. October 28th through 30th, really big poker game. And, you know, we'll have it cordoned off so people can't stand right behind the players and look over their shoulders and see that. But because one of the nice things is this room is enclosed and there are windows all around, people will be able to stand outside those windows and watch the game as it goes down. And we expect a lot of stuff going on in the room that weekend. So that's what's coming up at the end of October. Between now and then, of course, the World Series of Poker circuit events get going. This Thursday is the first one of the 2011-2012 season. It's going to be at the Horseshoe in Bossier City, Louisiana. And do you like what they've done this year, Dennis, changing the structure a little bit so that they do 12 days and 12 rings? That's their theme this year.
It is, and they've jammed everything together, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You can go down there and concentrate on poker for a week, week and a half, and get a lot of playing in. It really makes it worthwhile to go to one of these circuit events. They've got one coming up fairly close to the Midwest. There's going to be one over at Elizabethtown here in just a few weeks, too, and then the one up at Hammond in Chicago at the end of October.
Yep.
So if you're around the St. Louis area and you want to participate in one of these circuit ones before the ones that's held in St. Louis in April, there's a couple of them coming up very, very quickly. And I know the guys at both those facilities, and they'll take care of you. Last year, the biggest circuit event, I believe, of all of them was at Hammond, Indiana. Jason Newman's the director up there. He runs a heck of a good tournament. They had a ton of people up there for that whole series. Largest one of all the circuit events, and it probably will be again this year. They got a heck of a nice room up there, and it's a sister property to there in St. Louis. And let me tell you, be some good playing and some good large fields.
Absolutely. All right, time now for our guest, a member of this year's November 9, Matt Gianetti, who not only made the November 9 this year, but had four previous World Series of Poker caches going back to 2008, including two other final tables. We're happy to have him here today on our final table. Hi, Matt, how are you?
Oh, not bad. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on the show. Congratulations on making the November 9. Have you done any work to get ready for it yet?
Well, I mean, I play poker almost every day, but, I mean, as far as prepping specifically for the final table, I haven't really gotten into any of that yet.
Are you planning on getting help from anybody? What will your prep involve once you get to it?
Well, I believe ESPN's giving us all the film. I'll go through all that with, you know, I have some good buddies that, you know, I trust their opinion, and I think we think the game's somewhat similar, and you know, we'll like collaborate and try to come up with you know, the best plan of attack.
Well, I know you play a lot of or you've had a lot of success playing PLO and some of the others. Are you going to, in November, then concentrate on nothing but tournaments, avoid the cash, avoid the PLO, the other stuff, and try on no limit? And are you going to try and play maybe some short tabled ones, 6-handed, 5-handed, 4-handed? Is that going to help you out any?
Oh, well, I mean, I just got to Miami today to play some cash games. The end of the week, I'm going to be going to France to play the Partouche poker tournament over there. And, you know, I think that starting the end of this week, I'll go into more of a tournament mode, which is not that common for me to do. But I think that, you know, with what my friends are telling me, that, you know, that's probably the best thing for me to do right now, to try to, you know, just pick up as much as I can in tournaments.
Matt, even before you got to day eight, on day seven, you were also at one of the feature tables on TV. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the way ESPN and Poker Productions did the live streaming, showing the hole cards, and how did you perhaps exploit that by having friends help you get information?
Well, yeah, I had somebody watching at all times, and if I had any question, you know, I'd know 30 minutes later, you know, what the hands were. But it really changed the whole dynamic of the game because, you know, just if you bluff somebody, they are going to know that you bluffed them in 30 minutes. So you have to know how to adjust your game to, you know, play off of that correctly. And it really changed the whole dynamic of the game, like, considerably.
Talking about hands, you had a key hand there on day seven when you went against Ben Lamb. The one where you went into the tank for, I don't know how long, it must have been 10 minutes there. Briefly, I know you know the hand. I just, for the viewers, it was 150, 300,000 for the blinds, 40,000 ante, so there's a substantial amount out there pre-flop. Ben raised it to 675 from the cutoff, and then you called out of the big blind, and as it turned out, you had an ace-nine. Well, you flopped an ace-nine-deuce. Now, you were first to act and checked. He bet 700,000, a typical continuation bet. You called. Turn brought the seven. Second diamond, and there's two hearts out there also. And it went check, check, and then river to two heart. You checked there on the river, and Ben bets over 4 million into a pot of only 3 million. Totally overbet the pot. And then you tanked for like 10 minutes. my thoughts, do you like the way you played the hand? Would you have played it different in hindsight? Did you have some sort of a read on Ben that you, you know, we were trying to draw more money from him? You flopped top two.
Yes. Well, I thought it was better to flat call on the flop because I was pretty sure he didn't have much. I thought giving him an opportunity to, you know, maybe hang himself was better than, you know, because the only way I can get paid really if I check raise that flop is if he has an ace. So, I mean, I felt like it was unlikely that he had anything that could pay me off, so I just flat called the flop. And as far as calling on the river, it was looking back, obviously I wish I folded, but he did something in the hand that made me think that there was almost no way he could have a flush in his hand. And because I also knew that he knows I like to play a lot of flops, so I thought it was pretty unlikely that he would have raised in particularly my big blind with a deuce in his hand. So, I mean, if I rule out a flush, the only way I can get beat is if he has a deuce. And I agonized over a while, but I thought he wouldn't have raised my big blind with a deuce in his hand. But then, you know, on the other side of things, I also didn't really feel like he would bet $4 million to a $3 million chip pot without a hand that had me beat. But, you know, I made a bad decision there.
Yeah, turned out that Matt had deuce three, and he rivered trips when that second deuce came. Go ahead, Dennis.
Well, I was just wondering if maybe part of your thought process, too, you're this deep in the main event, you're going against a gentleman who I believe at the time had more chips than you did. Were you trying to maybe play a little small ball, trying to keep control of the pot and the pot size?
I mean, I'm definitely, you know, not afraid to put my chips in, but it was I genuinely thought when he bet the flop that he had absolutely nothing, and I thought there was way more value in flat calling and allowing him to, you know, pick up something because I thought for sure if I check raised, I wasn't going to get any action. And, like, if he's a very, very good player, obviously. So, I mean, he's going to, you know, value bet quite a bit. Like let's say he had two jacks and bets the flop. He's going to bet the turn with two jacks most of the time because it's such a draw heavy board that he could, you know, honestly think that he's just protecting his hand. And, you know, I just thought there was a lot more value in the flat call and giving him some room to.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So when you check the turn and he checks behind, you hear that little Homer Simpson dope inside your head?
Yeah, that definitely was not a. he checked it so fast too, and then yeah, it was a little sick feeling. But I mean, you know, I still think that you know, let's say he had a hand like king queen like that. If he might bet the flop and check behind on the turn, and then if he picks up a king or a queen on the river, just to, you know, try to show you my perspective in the hand is that he's a good enough player that, you know, I think he's probably value betting a king or queen on the river if he has king, queen, a king or queen comes. So I'm kind of giving myself, you know, more opportunities to win money. I mean, if he actually has, like, a legitimate draw, it sucks. But, I mean, if you think that, you know, he plays quite a few hands and that, you know, in the long run he's not going to have, you know, a lot of outs, then, you know, that was my view in the hand. But, for him to bet $4 million on the river into a $3 million chip pot, I should have, you know, probably should have thought about it a little more, or I mean, I thought about it a long time, but I mean, I probably should have folded.
To be honest with you, I've looked at it, I've reviewed it, I've watched the play before and after it. Unfortunately, I probably would have called there too, so don't feel too bad. I think I would put my $4 million out there too, I have to admit. I was a little bit surprised, especially against you, that he would be raising with a deuce three offsuit.
Yeah, in my big blind in particular, that was
exactly
my feeling.
Yeah.
That was actually, it turned out to be a very good move by him. But, I think there were other areas you could have picked on a little easier. Let's put it that way.
And when you said you saw something earlier that told you he was not on a flush draw, was part of that the fact that he didn't fire the second barrel? It's likely in a situation like that where if he does have any kind of flush draw there, he's going to fire the second barrel on the turn?
I mean, Ben's a very good, very, like, tricky kind of player, so I don't think you can ever peg him as far as, like, he's always going to do this there. But he just did something that, you know, through all my years of playing cash games and stuff, you know, makes me think a certain thing, which obviously I don't want to say because, you know, it can just be used against me. But I mean,
absolutely. We asked him about this, and he didn't want to say anything about you either.
Yeah, it's going to be quite the mental mind games going back and forth. So absolutely. I'm sure we're both trying to keep everything close to the vest.
Yep.
Well, one thing I did ask both Phil Collins and I also asked Ben, I want to ask you too, not your particular philosophy or whether you're going to change it or you're going to be picking on anybody, but do you see anybody at the table whose game you think will substantially change between July and when you guys come back in November?
I wouldn't be surprised at all if I in November I thought that, you know, a handful of the guys played entirely differently than how they had played before, just because there's just going to be so many people talking in everybody's ear, like, oh, they should do this, they should do that. So I'm anticipating that it's going to happen. Do I know specifically who that's going to be? No.
We only have about 30 seconds left, unfortunately, here, but I want to ask you one other question about the hand with Ben. You tanked for 10 minutes. Do you think that there should be a shot clock in poker?
Maybe. I mean, that is a little excessive and that is a little ridiculous by me. But, I mean, nobody at the table called the clock on me because they'd all played with me enough hours to know that this is extremely uncharacteristic for me to tank like that and that, you know, it was a legitimate decision. So, I mean, it might be a good idea. I mean, it's just – I felt like, you know – I do it so rarely that, you know, I was able to, tank longer than most people would.
Yeah. I'm sorry we don't have more time with you. Hopefully we'll get a chance to do that again with you later on this year. In the meantime, good luck in those very lucrative South Florida live cash games and over at Partouche as well. And good luck in November if we don't talk to you before then, Matt.
All right. Thank you very much.
Matt Gianetti, one of this year's November 9 for the WSOP main event, joining us here on the final table. Dennis, I'll talk to you next week when Christy Gazes will be our guest.
Sounds like a plan.
He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, available on iTunes and on thechipleader.com anytime on demand and live every Tuesday from the Poker Room of Harris St. Louis on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.